Hey, happy lunchtime, everybody. It's the 600 Club coming at you live from the USS Enterprise. And we got a great show lined up for you today. We're very happy to be having Kevin Annette back on the show. He's been here a few times. And Kevin, good to see you.
Hi, Hugh. Great to be back.
And just for people that may not know who you are, I mean, I know you get around. I see you all over the internet these days, but somebody was asking me yesterday, who's on the show tomorrow? And I said, oh, it's the guy that brought down the last Pope. And I know we've had you on before. I think you were on our show when you revealed the Brantford, the graves that were found at the Brantford School.
That's right.
And you're, I guess, one of the co-founders or the founder of the Republic of Kanata and all kinds of other stuff. So do you want to fill in some of those details for people before we get into what we're going to be talking about today?
Well, I've had the last 30 years, very eventful circumstance, helping to expose all these crimes of genocide in Canada and increasingly all over the world involving the death of children, things that are, you know, acceptable issues to talk about now, but which many years ago weren't. What that's done is that, you know, in the case of helping to bring down Pope Benedict, shows you the power of the truth. All we did is took a lot of the evidence we had from the so-called Indian residential schools in Canada, spread it all over the world, found that there were a lot of similar cases involving the Vatican in other countries, brought that all together, created a citizens' tribunal. And we also shared that evidence with various governments in Europe. And 6 days before Pope Benedict announced his resignation, the Spanish government had notified him that he could face arrest if he came to Spain based on the evidence they saw in our docket. So then he steps down, first pope who does so in six centuries, right? Not coincidence. Just shows you the power of the truth. And it's easy to get discouraged these days, but we say to people all the time, learn from that experience. If stand on your truth, never give up, and you'll get amazing results.
And I'm going to mention, too, you are a former, at least correct me if I'm wrong, but former United Church minister.
Oh, yes.
and that's sort of how that was a big part of how you got started in all this activism.
That's right. It was out on the West Coast in Port Alberni. And I just began to, you know, I arrived there in 1992 with my wife and two small daughters. I began to ask questions about why there were no Indians in the churches. No one wanted to talk about it. And until I began to take food out to the local reservation, the local people there were telling me all sorts of stories of children being killed in the local United Church residential school, being buried out back. I began talking about that. I opened my pulpit to them. Next thing I knew, I was out on my can. And the church went to my divorce and to my wife and offered to pay for her divorce if she left me. I mean, kind of standard approach, how you deal with a whistleblower. You take out their family and livelihood. But that just made me even more popular among natives. We began to bring on more stories. A whole campaign culminated over 25 years, forcing out the so-called apology and all of this truth of those death camps they still call residential schools, right?
Mm-hmm. So, okay. So, I know you're coming to Ontario soon, but what do you want to bring to people's attention today? How do you want to start this?
Well, you know, Hugh, we always say that the crimes of the past are very much connected to the crimes of the present. And, you know, good and bad, that's true. There's always a continuity of our lives and history. And the things that we've been looking into over the last 6 months to the year has been the evidence of Chinese expansion all over Western Canada, the collusion of Aboriginal chiefs in selling off the lands and resources, but also the overt murder of Native people in Canada. There were 10 Cree Indians killed in eastern Saskatchewan 2 years ago. And it turned out it was connected to a whole operation by Rio Tinto Diamond Mines to get their land. There was one chief who didn't want to sell out. Then next thing you know, six of his relatives are murdered in one night by a lone gunman with a knife who then conveniently dies in an RCMP prison. It smells this whole thing of the usual kind of land grab and then cover up that Canada is notorious for. And so those examples, I think, putting it in the bigger geopolitical context of China and its expansion, thanks to the Trudeau and Harper governments, they can buy up the whole country now and even station their troops in Canada. So I, you know, these are some of the breaking stories that are happening, you know, to show this continuity of genocide that we talk about all the time.
You know, I can't help think that, you know, I'm imagining, I mean, we've seen over the last couple of years, basically the powers that be, the Canadian government, and this goes beyond just Canada, but we're in the Canadian context here. The government, the media, the big corporate sector, kind of at war, at least in my opinion, against the Canadian people, forcing mm-hmm. them to get vaccines, forcing them to have their businesses shut down with the lockdown and that sort of thing. And it's kind of like, okay, and we hear these reports, like I remember hearing a report about there's that thing, the Committee of 300, that they made a decision back in the late 70s that they wanted to kind of deindustrialize North America.
Right.
And that's what we've seen over the last generation, is we've seen so much manufacturing move to China. And, yep. and we see these, and what these, I think what these globalist people like the Council of 300 and others like them, they're going, oh, North America is so difficult, because back then there was a lot of labor strife. The unions wanting more and more money for that industrial work that they were doing. And so those big globalist corporate people just said, well, let's move all the manufacturing to China.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we won't have those unions to worry about anymore. The Chinese will, you know, have a mindset that's less individualistic, and they'll be happy to be working, you know, and just making this stuff and not getting paid that much. So from the globalist point of view, it's a good idea to move everything, to move the manufacturing to China, destabilize North America. And it seems to me now, with some of the stuff that's going on, that North America has already been handed over to the Chinese. And it's just a question of, you know, filling in the details to get to the point where the American ideal no longer even exists in the world.
I think you've hit it right on the nail on the head there with many things. What you're saying is very accurate. Over the last 50 years, you see in the world economy, the center of the global economy now is in North America, Europe, and Japan. It's China and the Southern Asia region. As a matter of fact, 3/4 of all new economic growth is happening in the Indo-Pacific region. So economies like Vietnam have a 2,400% GNP growth rate every year. America has 170%. You know, so it gives you a sense of balance that China is kind of like where America was after World War II. It's the rising power. America is where Britain was. It's the declining power. And Russia's kind of the brokering power that, you know, number two, but in relation to China. But the point is that it's like the world that George Orwell predicted in 1984, three power blocks all fighting for power, warring with each other, but not against each other, warring in order to keep their own people in place. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole COVID economy, the whole police state created 4 years ago. It was an attack mostly here on our minds to try to get people to agree to these stupid, arbitrarily disprovable theories about a so-called pandemic. You know, Hugh, on that whole issue, I've been going around for the last 4 years working with, as you know, I work with all sorts of people, homeless, native people. You'd think that long ago I would have got this bug. I never masked. I never got the shot or anything. I've never been sick, and I've never met anyone who is actually sick. I think people were getting sick, but for a lot of other reasons that they all put on this one thing. Why? Well, I mean, Big Pharma is the biggest lobby group in government. And you know, people aren't stupid. We know what's going on. We live in a corporatocracy, not a democracy. And the importance of fighting this stuff is to show that it isn't just reacting. We need to build an alternative. And that was the idea behind the Republic of Canada, but also I work with groups all over the world. I was just talking yesterday online with a group in Italy. They're setting up, like what we've suggested, local assemblies where people pass their own laws, restore democracy and the rule of law in their communities.
Mm-hmm.
That's in our hands to do. We're not waiting on some member of parliament to do, because they've all taken an oath of loyalty to Charlie Boy in London anyway, right? We need to take governance into our own hands and the law, and that's really the positive outcome of a lot of this stuff, right?
So that's a I agree 100%. And I don't know if, you know, there's a few people that we've spoken with over the years here at that channel that are kind of, and you probably know some of them, Kevin, I think, you know, what Cal Washington is doing. Mm-hmm. And what, I don't know if you know Doug Force.
No, but
he's talking about with his project's called The Myth is Canada. But that's what he's saying. He's saying that there is no Canada. There's no de jure government of Canada. It's a de facto government. There's that has no, you know, there's no legitimacy to it in law. And what he's saying, I mean, what Doug's saying is that the really the Statute of Westminster basically ended the British North America Act, and then it was up to the provinces that came together under Confederation, but now are free to form their own provincial, I guess, councils. I'm not sure what it is, but that seems to be what you're doing to some extent, is you're putting together these local councils all across the country.
Yes, but there's more. First of all, I want to go back a bit more historically, because it isn't just the Statute of Westminster in 1926. It's right back in 1649, England had a revolution. Cromwell and the boys cut off the king's head, and under an act of parliament in March 1649, they abolished forever the monarchy, the British monarchy, and the House of Lords. It was a crime of treason to reimpose the monarchy. They had an English republic. Well, Charles II restored the monarchy 11 years later in a military coup, but that made it a de facto power, not a de jure power. Mm-hmm. And so these folks are right. Ever since 1649, there has been no crown authority, but all of Canada was founded on this lie, this corporate fiction. And because of that, the indigenous groups, not the chief and council that are paid by the government, but the traditional indigenous leadership, the clan mothers and others, have always recognized there's no such thing as a treaty. We don't sign away the land to this fictitious foreign body. It's always been in the hands of the people. And on that basis, we're forming, like you say, assemblies with these folks, but in a bigger framework, because if you balkanize and split up the country, that'll play into China's hands. They want the whole country divided into little pieces. We need an overarching republic framework, like in theory they have in the United States, where the people are sovereign. There's no one sovereign, because the people as a whole are sovereign, and we express that lawfully. You know, I remember I was stopped the other day by a Mountie, and he looked at my, he ran my ID through the computer, and he said, he came back with a concerned look in his face. He said, "Are you Kevin Annett?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Good luck." And then I handed him a flyer about the Republican and say, "Don't forget, nullify your oath of allegiance to Charles, take it to the people." So, it shows you that if you're bold and you're just out there, you've got a lot of support. I think 58% of Canadians want a republic. We don't want ties to this anachronism anymore called the British Crown. So, it's a matter now of acting on that, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. Those oaths, they're not to the people of Canada. They're to the British Crown. So
I swear true allegiance to Charles and his descendants, period. Mm-hmm. Every member of parliament, every judge, every soldier, every cop does that. And that means they're not accountable to anybody except one man in London.
Okay. So, and the other thing we were going to talk about, and it's going to tie in here, we're tying it in. Yeah. So this idea that North America, including Canada, is being handed over to China.
Yeah.
And you and I were chatting before the show. We've both noticed some evidence of that, and one of them is one of the ones that I've noticed is this. Increasingly, if you go to public events and that sort of thing, there's this thing that people do at the beginning of the event, which is to acknowledge the native people and the unceded land that we're on and that sort of thing. And I don't know where this came from, but all of a sudden a few years ago, I started seeing this, and now I'm seeing it almost everywhere. I mean, do you have any comments about that?
It comes from the federal government, i.e. the Assembly of First Nations, which is an arm of the Department of Indian Affairs. The AFN is supposed to represent all Native people. It's 633 self-appointed chiefs who were never elected by Native people. And they're a wing of the government. They even share offices with with Indian Affairs, and they come up with these things. They came up with the term First Nations because a First Nation is a corporation. It means they're no longer the original. Well, the term Aboriginal means not of the original group. Mm-hmm. They're a corporation now which can alienate, sell off their own land to the resort, to various corporations. They were set up that way. That's what the treaties are all about. They become, in essence, a local municipality. They can sell off their, what couldn't be sold off according to customary Indigenous law. You can't sell the land and the resources to somebody else. It belongs to the creator and to be used by everybody. But that corporate notion has entered in, and unfortunately, these native chiefs, and that's where the residential schools came in. They were factories to turn out, to kill off half the children, but also to turn out a client slave class of puppet chiefs who would do the bidding of the government. And if you ever talk to these guys, they're more white than the whites in the way they think. They disregard their own people. I remember when I first started in Port Alberni as a minister. We called him Five Car George. He was George Watts, the local tribal council chief, and he had five cars, big house. Everybody else on the reservation are starving to death. We went to him to get help for our food bank because most of the people using it were native. He said, those lazy bums, they should get a job, right? I mean, it's that kind of the attitude you find all through that, you know, that class of puppet chiefs, which is not unusual. I mean, the British did that all over the world. They did in India, you know, the credit client class to manage the empire for them. And it's those people now who are, you know, pushing these things like the acknowledgement, you know, the little ritual people do where they acknowledge the land. No, they're not. That formula, what it says is we're acknowledging that these puppet chiefs have the right now to sell off and use the land however they like, i.e. to sell it off to China. On the West Coast, the chiefs have signed $8 billion in oil and gas deals with China since 2015. And they're owning the biggest Trans Mountain pipeline now is owned by native chiefs, Enbridge Oil. Native people are protesting the pipelines, and yet the native chiefs are making deals with the pipelines to line their own pockets. So, I mean, it's designed, it's more brainwashing for white people to make us think, oh, good, we're doing the right thing by native people. In fact, no, you're making it worse for your average native person, that whole thing, because it gives people a sense of, oh, we're acknowledging people when, in fact, we're not. The cover-up of the genocide and this ongoing crime, I mean, it continues today, right?
So, yeah. So what you're saying is that there's and I've heard about this, too, that there's two kinds of there's like the government-sanctioned native governance, right? And you're saying that this group is the government-sanctioned native governance that's signing deals with China. And then we've got the kind of governance that comes from the native communities themselves, and that these two groups are at odds with each other.
Completely.
And one is sanctioned by the government. Those are the ones that's signing deals with the Chinese. And so I'll just tell you a little story, because when I was out in Vancouver last summer, and this is just to back up what you just said, I was somewhere in Vancouver near one of the beaches and with Joseph Roberts from Common Ground Magazine. And he was telling me that there was the Canadian armories there, which was federal government property, that had just been handed over to the native groups. And the native groups now were signing deals with Chinese developers. So this property now that's owned by the government or the collective Canadian people is now going to be developed into super high density condo developments by the Chinese, but nobody can say anything because it's the natives.
Yeah, they call it, in the corporate world, they call it redwashing. You put a native puppet on your board and then you log off all the old growth forests, and the environmentalists don't dare attack, you know, that, because it's a native operation. You know, the largest and the only logging company logging off the last of the old growth trees on Vancouver Island is Ilsec Limited. It's 100% owned by the Ahouset Band Council. So the native people logging off the last of the grandfathers, you know, 300-foot tall cedar trees are all going down the toilet thanks to a native logging company. So, I mean, it's not about white versus native. It's very much a class issue. You know, native elites versus the majority of their people who are impoverished. and are living out the consequence of this unresolved genocide, which is carrying on, right? Mm.
Yeah, and if I was the government or somebody or the industrial techno structure, and I wanted to get a pipeline through to the West Coast to ship, you know, liquefied natural gas to China, but I have to deal with native protesters who don't want those pipelines going through virgin forest and such, that would, it sounds like a good idea to get some of these native governance groups to, you know, get on the board so that they can sign the deals with China. And then exactly. That way, and nobody can say anything.
Follow the money. You know, it's always about that. But I mean, you know, it gets even worse. Like Vancouver is my old bailiwick. I grew up there. I did street ministry there for a long time. That's where our whole campaign began. And when you go down and you look on the streets on East Hastings and along the border along Main Street, it's unbelievable what goes on. And their native chiefs, you know, do you remember the whole missing women inquiry that the federal government started?
In Vancouver, around the Picton
farm. Well, I mean, you know, I remember there was a CSIS agent, former CSIS agent named Grant Wakefield, who met with me, and he had infiltrated Piggy's Palace, and he said that wasn't the killing ground. The Picton brothers were the body disposal crew. Guess where they were carrying the bodies? They were dumping them on the Musqueam Indian Reservation, right at the UBC campus. And we even had people go in. We took samples to the SFU forensic. They analyzed them. Yes. Women's bones and pig bones all mixed together. Dave and Willie Picton were taking bags out to the Musqueam Reserve as early as 1998. And twice the charges were stayed against them when they were reported because the high ranking federal politicians and chiefs like Chief Ed John, who works there, who have a long time been implicated in things like drug trafficking, child trafficking on the reservations, all that. All of that came out in our first tribunal in June 1990 in Vancouver. All of those charges stayed, all those people protected, and the people who pointed fingers at them vanished, either killed or went into hiding because they're being threatened. I mean, these reservation chiefs, it's like a mafia operation. And I'll give you a little anecdote of that. In Manitoba, on the Long Plains Reservation, my friend Peter Yellowquill, who's a traditional Anishinaabeg Ojibwe, tried to get up at a band council meeting and challenge the fact that Dennis Meeches, who was the chief, was running, even though he was prohibited from doing so because there were criminal charges against him. But he ran anyway and got elected. He challenged him, and the Mounties and the Indian agent people are sitting there, and they just let this Dennis Meeches threaten Peter. And that same month, his trailer gets burned down. His son gets arrested by the Mounties. They put the screws to Peter for naming this crime, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't hesitate naming these names because we've been naming these names for almost three decades now. I've never been sued once. Nobody has ever been sued for mentioning this stuff because they know it's true. And the last thing they want is to get this into a court of record, right? They just try to hope everyone will not believe it and, you know, ignore Kevin Annett because – well, the RCMP smear campaign in me goes back almost 30 years now, right?
Wait, Kevin, I'm just going to put up the disclaimer. Just
yeah. These are my – this these, is not you.
These are your opinions, and that's what this show's all about, and we may get censored off of all sorts of social media platforms, but we are trying to get to the truth here because I think there's a lot at stake. And I think a lot of people don't realize the extent to which we're really in potentially a lot of trouble. And, you know, all the supports of our current society seem to be being taken away one by one. And then one day that one that's keeping everything up is going to fall away and we're going to find ourselves in a very different world the next day. So
exactly. And as a matter of fact, and take something like the, before I say that, that whole comment about Long Plains Reservation, mm-hmm. If you invite Peter Yellowquill on, he's spoken on my show, he'll repeat everything I said and give you even more. So we do have people to confirm this just, you know, for the people concerned that this is not coming out of my mind. This was, I witnessed at the Long Plains Reserve and that. So,
well, this is, I just want to say for people that may not have heard, because we're going out to an international audience here, about the Picton Pig Farm. I heard somebody, maybe it was you even, Kevin, I was watching some interview, and somebody basically described the Picton Pig Farm as Canada's Epstein Island.
Well, one of many, but yeah, that's one thing in the news.
And there was a few years ago, it was big news item across Canada. All these girls were going missing, and there were rumors of all these elite parties and stuff happening over there. But what happened? I mean, what was the outcome? Did all the charters get dropped?
What was the outcome to the Residential School Inquiry, the TRC, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, set up by the guilty parties, the churches and government, to investigate themselves? Was there one criminal charge laid for the death of over 60,000 children? You know, no. It's a typical thing, a crime without criminals. You talk about it like they talk about graves being discovered, but they never do forensic examination that are shared publicly. They never bring criminal charges. I mean, what if a mass grave of 100 white kids was found? Don't you think there'd be criminal charges laid against somebody? Not in this case, because you see, under the law, Native people are not citizens. They're wards of the crown. So there's no consequence when you kill them. They're not citizens of Canada. And so people know they can get away with all this stuff legally under Canadian law, just like the Nazis did under their laws. But yeah. So anyway, there was that other part you asked me about before I mentioned about the Long Plains.
Epstein Island?
No. Anyway, it'll come back.
Okay. You know what? Let's do this. Because I want to – we're going to come back. I'm going to do a commercial break right now. But when we come back, I want to start maybe focusing on this idea of if North America is being handed over to somebody,
okay,
let's find out what, if anything, we can do about that. So
good.
We'll get started on that when we come back from these commercials in a couple of minutes. All right, we're back on the show here. We're going to try to get some solutions here. But I was just thinking, one of the things we mentioned in the first part of the show was this kind of ritual that's now happening at public events where we acknowledge the Native people that are here and their unceded land and all that sort of thing. And what that triggers in my head is like, okay, so if we're on their land and it's unceded, then there's no such thing as private property. And right. And so, I mean,
it's just a word game.
Well, okay, but you know, that's some would argue that one of the pillars of Western free enterprise civilization is the idea of private property. So if somebody's kind of undermining that idea, then one day they can pull the plug on that and we create the globalist socialist superstate.
Well, the trouble with words is that they don't really mean anything. Our modern culture, the language has become dead. You know, people say genocide. What does that mean? Does it mean children being systematically raped, tortured, and thrown into a ditch? Can you hear the cries of a dying child with the word genocide? No.
That could be collateral damage.
You know, all the language is designed to befuddle and distance. So really, none of the isms really describe anything. It's about, you know, the whole notion of politics and identity. These are abstractions. There's no such thing as Canada or anything. There's just people. How are we going to live together? How are we going to acknowledge the wrongs we've done? Honestly, not in the Canadian context, because the last thing people want to do when you talk about Native people is look at the hard evidence. I mean, if you go to murderbydecree.com, you'll see on their documents that we published as early as 1998 showing half the children were being systematically murdered in these death camps called residential schools for over half a century. Well, the way they did it is they would take the healthy, put them in with the sick, lock them together. They die of TB and smallpox. Deliberate germ warfare, a death rate double that of Auschwitz. Yet it's not called genocide. Finally called genocide, you know, in a kind of patronizing way. Oh, yeah, pat them on the head. But no consequence, right? Mm-hmm. And you said earlier, you know, the thing happening to all of us now, the police state, that came out of the genocide we did to Native people. An example of that is it's been the law in Canada since 1874 that if you're a Native living on a reservation, you cannot refuse a shot or you go to jail. You can't refuse medical treatment. So every time the big pharma wanted to test out a new drug, they'd pay the churches. Churches would hand over a whole bunch of Native kids to their Indian hospitals. They'd try out these drugs, kill a lot of them, bury the bodies. And, you know, so now all that's happening is we're all on the reservation. You know, this is, nothing's happened to us now that didn't happen to our brown neighbors for many years, yet where were all of us? Mm-hmm. You can call a demonstration now about these crimes of genocide and you'd get five people to come out to it. Mm-hmm. You know, but 50,000 turn out over an issue overseas or whatever, not to belittle those other issues, but people have an aversion to looking at their own crimes and they'll do any mental gymnastics to avoid doing that. And that's what we encounter. So the real question is, do we want to change? Do we want to accept responsibility for what we did and are still doing? You know?
Well, it almost seems that it's hard to motivate people or to, you know, people, so many people still don't realize, as I said at the beginning, the kind of trouble that I think we're really in. And I find it increasingly difficult to even have a conversation with people because, and we saw that over the pandemic, how, right. And I think it was a deliberate strategy used to kind of, as a wedge to divide families, to divide people from each other. You got two camps, the vax camp, the unvax camp, right?
Yeah.
So where do we go from here? I mean, how do we really, like, what is the, okay, here we're talking about the, you know, maybe North America getting handed over to the Chinese, like, and we're, you know, government run amok, the Canadian government signing the World Health Organization treaty, at least they're probably going to do it. I can't see Trudeau not doing that. That's handing over the whole management of any kind of next pandemic to the UN and the World Health Organization, which can only be bad news for everybody.
Well, only if we cooperate with it. I mean, you know, here's the thing. Working for many years with survivors, you learn that the language is all important because people in a healing circle, and I don't like that term healing, it's a white term. Nothing's ever healed, frankly. But we can manage it to some degree, the pain and trauma of our life. And we can transform sometimes. But this healing, I mean, it's going back to a status quo that never existed in a way. But in these circles, people will never, they always talk about this was done to me, but that's victim thinking. We always cooperate to some degree with our own situation. We're all cooperating. A law comes down. Well, no, we don't have to abide by the law. It's an old principle in common law. You talked about the Western traditions of common law. Time and again in the U.S. Supreme Court and in English common law, they say statute without consent is not law.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the government brings in a statute. No, I'm not harming anybody. I don't agree with it. I don't have to go along with it. Now, an American will get that. Because they're raised with the idea that they're a citizen of a republic and the government serves them. Canada, it's confusing because we're taught, what are you raised to think of yourself as? A subject of the crown, right? Mm-hmm. You obey their law. You have to go along, right? No, you don't. Our oldest traditions going back over 1,000 years in England say, you know, we govern ourselves. We are the law. We are the government and we can depose the government anytime we like if it's tyranny. That's our innate inbred right to do that as human beings. Now, all we have to do is act on that. And a lot of people get that, but they're waiting for an example. They're waiting for leadership on this. And where is the leadership? I mean, all the political parties take an oath of allegiance to obey Charlie Boy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why we say disavowing the oath, establishing local governance, and teaching people the stuff they've never learned in Canada, that they are innately sovereign and capable of saying no, stepping out of any arrangement they didn't agree to. I mean, when you were born and you were registered at birth, you didn't agree to have that capital name, you know, given
that's
to you.
Right. That was a fraud. That was fraud.
Yeah. It's imposed on you. So you step out of it. That's my artificial self, not my natural being, right?
So, and what else do we do, Kevin? I mean, you're advocating for these local councils you've established or helped establish the Republic of Kanata.
Mm-hmm.
And is this all kind of lawful? Because we know,
yes.
Like, ideally, we would like to establish a de jure government or governance for Canada.
Which we don't have right now. We do not live under the rule of law and the de jure government. So we often say to people, we're establishing the rule of law. We're not breaking any law. You know, and that's the point. When people say, I often get this, when we hold, it's really an exciting process here. We get 12 people to sign a charter and start meeting. And those 12 people or more can start passing laws in their community and enforcing them. And a question you get 90% of the time is, do we have the right to do this? And I said, where does our authority come from? I say, go look in the mirror. That's the source of your authority. Under creation, under God, however you want to put it, you are innately have the right to govern yourself as long as you're not harming anybody. But you can step out of any agreement that was forced it on you, especially a contract that you never agreed to, right? Like in Canada, they assume silence is consent. You don't disagree, do you, with what we're doing? Therefore, it's valid. No, it isn't. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first thing we say to people. And it's getting over that mental hurdle. That's the biggest part. The way you do that is in practice. So, for example, one of the things we did in some of our early assemblies out west is we not only nullify the COVID laws and said, you don't have the right to impose these things on us as citizens of the Republic, but we nullified federal taxes and we kept the taxes in our community. We started to do that. We went to the mayors of some small towns and said, you know, we're withholding the tax to the federal government because most federal taxes go towards paying debts to banks. They don't help the people at all. Mm-hmm. They don't help schools, hospitals, highways that come out of provincial and local taxes. So keep the federal tax money in the community. That's a really popular issue. And then we can start using the revenue to fund our own notion of what Canada should be, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the whole that raises for me the currency issue is a big one, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're just because with a currency right now, even doing that, we're using the federal government currency system, we're using federal government dollars and that sort of thing, and of course the whole money system as it is designed more as a control mechanism than as a way to facilitate people's wealth. Okay. So now how are these, you get 12 people minimum to sign what is it that they're signing?
It's a charter. It's a common law charter, which says that we 12 people designate ourselves as a lawful assembly to pass laws in our community and enforce them. And, to create courts, common law courts, where, you know, it's taking the law back into our own hands, not like in Canada, crown appointed judges can nullify records. They can throw out jury decisions. They're dictators. It's not really the rule of law. It's, if you go into courts now, it's really operating as an administrative tribunal where you're assumed to be guilty. And I know having gone through a United Church, kangaroo court, that threw me out illegally from the church. I know that these church or RCMP or crown courts, they all operate like medieval, they were called star chambers. You're assumed to be guilty. You don't have the right to call witnesses. You don't have the right to examine evidence. You got to admit, like in a medieval witch hunt before an inquisition, you have to admit your guilt or you're persecuted for it.
Well, because that birth certificate thing that you mentioned, is that when we didn't have the capacity to enter into that contract when we were, you know, a baby. Right. But once we validate that, for example, by getting a social insurance number or a driver's license, we're saying, okay, I agree to that contract now. And then when you go to those courts, well, that's the jurisdiction you're in and you've agreed already to let them do whatever they want with you.
But you can step out and I often go say to people, first of all, don't go into the crown courts. And I was just working with a guy in Calgary the other day. He was set up to have his children taken like mine were, because if you speak out about anything in the native world, you're immediately targeted. They grab your kids, you're toast, right? So we say to people, don't go into crown courts because that's recognizing their authority. Mm-hmm. Convene your own local common law court, put them on trial. Issue summonses against them, call the judge and the lawyers and the other people going after you as human beings into your court. And if they don't, they're obstructing justice and you can issue citizen arrest warrants against them. Now, that's where it gets interesting because you go to the police and this works, Hugh. It worked when we were doing our church occupations about 10, 15 years ago. We're occupying peacefully on Sunday morning, the Catholic, the Anglican, the United Churches, and demanded to know where the mass graves were of over 60,000 children. When we did that, the police would show up, and I would go to them, and I said that you are serving, by protecting these churches, not only criminal bodies that have killed children, but their own policies say that when children are raped by priests, you're not to be told. The police are not to be told. That's a standing policy in the Vatican, the Catholic Church, called Crimen Solicitanus, goes back 100 years. So I said to the police, you're protecting criminal bodies by doing this. Do you want to be implicated that way? And every time I said that to them, they would get on the walkie-talkie and then leave. They wouldn't interfere. They wouldn't support us, but they wouldn't get involved because they knew we were standing on the law. Mm-hmm. We say to the same cops, take an oath of allegiance, join the Republic, which some of them have done, taken out citizenship, and we will deputize you as officers to enforce our warrants. At that point, you're reaching a pre-revolutionary situation because revolutions happen when the police and the army go over to the people. And we say to those people with the authority and the guns, you belong on the side of the people now, not these few corporate parasites who are running everybody's life, right?
And I'm just running the website republicofcanada.org. And one of your other sites, itccs.org, at the bottom.
No, itccs.org was taken out long ago. It's murderbydecree.com.
Okay.
That's right. And that's got everything on there as well, including my 24 books.
So, I hear what you're saying. And in fact, I heard that if you remember the truckers event in Ottawa, the truckers or the protesters were often talking to the police that were trying to enforce the whatever the government wanted it done. And they're saying, how can you, as a Canadian, how can you treat your fellow Canadians like this? And I found out afterward that some of these police officers, they actually stepped back. Like they've refused to, to be the enforcers. And of course they were disciplined by, their employers, but that's the kind of thing you can have when you're dealing with fellow Canadians. Right.
But it happens all the time. I see it happening all the time, Hugh.
But they're bringing in these, at least it looked like those guys that came in at the end of the truckers protest were foreigners. They were foreign soldiers of some sort. And so when you get people that don't identify with the group, that identify as other, then it's easier for, to enforce draconian policies on a population if it's being done by outsiders.
Well, don't forget the Foreign Investment Protection Act, which was introduced by the Harper government, passed by the Trudeau government. The very first thing they passed when Trudeau got in was the FIPA. FIPA allows the Chinese to station security forces on Canadian soil. Now, that includes police stations. There are, I believe, I was told, in Toronto alone, there's 5 police stations. Now, these are extraterritorial. They're not, if you walk in there, you're on Chinese territory. They're like embassies. Hello? Isn't that an act of treason? Just like allowing the Chinese People's Liberation Army to operate off the west coast of Canada on Canadian territory, which is they do all the time. As a matter of fact, a lot of the missing native families have been driven off the land in northern BC by Chinese death squads hired by Sinopec PetroChina to get the gas, oil and gas lines. And they're assisted in that by the RCMP. We have testimonies of people who witnessed that. I've witnessed it, these military maneuvers. So, there's that infiltration at every level. McFadden, his name was, he was head of CSIS back in 2010. He said the British Columbia government has been systematically infiltrated by China. Then he had to step down suddenly after saying that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this has been going on for a number of years, and it's systematic takeover.
Well, and we got the inquiry in Ottawa now about foreign interference. We had one member of parliament, I think, had to step down, Han Dong, who was in my riding at one point. I could have voted for Han Dong, but so they're looking into that in Ottawa officially, but this is Canada, so there'll probably be, as with all the other inquiries, probably any charges will be stayed. There will be no accountability in the long run.
it's a royal commission. I mean, it's like the serial killer investigating himself and saying, nope, didn't find anything under my house. I mean, that's the way it operates in Canada, right? Mm-hmm. Literally. Yeah. And so you got to operate outside their system. We say that again. Now, it's a difficult thing to imagine because people have to create something new, which is the most difficult thing to ever do, because we're always keeping our eyes on the past and wanting to make it comfy the way we do. But it's not comfortable. There'd be a lot of risk and everything, but it's a price you pay to create something new and to put power back in the hands of the people, which is what it's all about, right?
Well, I agree 100%. But I mean, I even had a conversation with somebody yesterday. A Canadian, right? And who understands the problems, you know, as well as you or I think, Kevin. But is saying, you know, it's like, we know our prime minister loves the Chinese way of doing things, at least the way that the Chinese Communist Party does things. Because it's just so much easier to get things done. You don't have to worry about people's rights or, people's private property. No, you can expropriate property at will, pay whatever you want, and then build that public infrastructure. You know, and some people that actually understand these issues in Canada are going, we really can't afford personal freedom and sovereignty anymore. No, it's just better to, have it where the state can do what it needs to do to manage the collective infrastructure on behalf of everybody. Seems to be the argument that's starting to carry the day.
It's a kind of corporatist, fascist attitude or whatever you want to call it, but Justin was raised like his father by Jesuits. And the Vatican and the Chinese are natural allies in this because they both have the same emperor worship notion of reality. That's why the Vatican Bank is underwriting Chinese expansion in North America to the tune of nearly $1 trillion a year. If you remember when Pope Francis came out to issue the quote apology to all of their murdered little victims. In fact, he met up in Prince Rupert on the West Coast with the Chinese to seal that deal. He and Pietro Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, they're underwriting the Chinese buying up of the whole infrastructure in North America. They're natural allies in this, and that's why China gets to appoint Catholic bishops. You know, there's a whole deal going on. Vatican has moved into the Chinese camp very much, their whole money and everything. And so that notion is what they're trying to oppose against the English common law tradition, which America was based on, which is that there is no authority greater than the will of the people. And if they try to do that, you have the legitimate right to overthrow them by any means necessary. That's right in the Bill of, the Bill of Rights and the American Constitution. That's why we've worked on that same model through the Republic of Canada. We got to fight for that or we'll all be slaves, right?
Absolutely. Well, the British have always been outliers. Even back in the Roman Empire, they were always causing trouble. The Roman soldiers didn't want to get posted there. Then you have the whole Vatican come up, and then there's Henry VIII, and he
right.
And the Reformation itself, right? Mm-hmm. So the Vatican, and then North America, arguably America itself, arguably the full flower of the Reformation. And so the Vatican, can perhaps understand why they would want to, kind of fight against that and work with somebody like the Chinese to do that.
I want to show you
let me
picture in that regard.
Yeah,
see that guy there?
Yeah.
That's my great-great-great-grandfather, Philip Annett. He took part in the rebellion in 1837 in Upper Canada. And he was a Baptist. And he took up arms because everybody had to pay taxes to the Church of England. And that republic, that attempted revolution was defeated. But, we're living in the legacy of that defeat, and we're just standing on the traditions of our ancestors.
Right. But, we've seen... I think we hear the stories about millions of immigrants that are just crossing the border in the U.S. Into the U.S. And we're in a sense we're seeing the same thing here in Canada. I mean, not that we have a big southern border to worry about so much, but we see the levels of immigration into Canada. And we've seen the same thing in Europe. And I think one of the perhaps rationales for that is that by letting a bunch of people here who at least not yet do not yet share the cultural values of what we have come to become here in Canada, then it's more difficult for the culture as a whole to stand up against this globalist agenda. And I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing these huge immigration numbers. It's just really part of a strategy to prevent the people in a country from rising up against the globalist agenda.
Well, I wish more Canadians would stand on their own traditions. Most Canadians don't know anything about their traditions of common law and personal liberty and that. And
well, they don't teach it in school because the education system has been hijacked as well.
Right.
To further the globalist agenda. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, well, the thing about immigration and that, I mean, if you're a few people, how do you get a few to rule the many? You get the many to fight each other. And I mean, it's that simple. It's been going that way for 6,000-7,000 years. Mm-hmm. And the best way to do that is bring in people who are unfamiliar to us. Now, of course, my family intermarried in Winnipeg with the Anishinaabe, the Cree, and the Métis. I've got like native relatives, right? And whenever we sit around and talk about immigration, stuff like that, they say, yeah, it's funny. That's what we thought too when you guys showed up. Like, what are you doing here on our land, right? But then you look around and you say, Canada has more space in the smallest, 40 million people now in a vast country. Said, I mean, if you're some poor starving slum dweller in Mexico, wouldn't you want to come here? I would. That isn't the issue. It's how people are then manipulated and used by, like, who's really going to profit by all this? That's always the question. Follow the money and see who's profiting from any issue, from any campaign. And that'll give the answer about, the secret agendas going on. Not too secret. I mean, that's the point. I mean, it's the same old agenda of, big bucks and power of a few over the many. And so, we have natural allies all over the world. I don't consider anyone my enemy, including the ones who did in my life, because people operate out of fear and ignorance. And we've got to break through that all the time. Mm-hmm. With reason and virtue. That was one of my grandfather's Bible, Philip Annett. He said, reason and virtue are the natural birthrights of every man and woman. We must act on them. And, says it in a nutshell, right?
Absolutely. And I just want to say, this isn't an anti-immigration thing, and it's not an anti-immigrant thing, but it's like, it's common sense. If people can't find a house or an apartment or can't find anything that's affordable, then we've got a supply and a demand. It's just a supply and demand issue. So let's increase, they're working as far to increase the supply, I think, as hard as they can, but with the demand keeps increasing. So, you want to have affordable housing. Well, why don't we start with maybe reducing the immigration numbers? And, and when I talk to people who are like new Canadians, I mean, they say the same thing, because we don't have a strategic, the same thing that meaning, yeah, let's be reasonable about the immigration numbers, because it's not going to do anybody any good to have large ethnic slums in the big cities with very low employment rates. That's not going to help anybody.
But that's not Crosby.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, take, for example, Newfoundland, which traditionally Canada's had one of the highest unemployment rates, also had the lowest immigration rate. Nobody wants to move to Newfoundland, right? So unemployment slums are not caused by immigration. They're caused by the nature of the system. And, right. And so there's other factors here, but it's kind of like the usual tyrannical argument is that everything is due to one factor. Some people said it was the Jews and others say it's immigrants and other. That's nonsense, because it's always a multiplicity of things that cause that. And we can't get caught up in these hysteria campaigns, which are designed to keep each other at one another's throats, right?
Right. But we could be increasing immigration, but we need to, there's no leadership, no strategic leadership from Ottawa about, okay, let's create new cities. Let's create new infrastructure. Let's bring the people in, and at least we'll have employment for them. And then they can, you know, live great lives and build a country. But there's none of that going on.
Well, of course not, because it goes back to that structural issue we talked about. Who is their oath of loyalty to? What are they told? And I know this, Sven Robinson used to be a friend of mine. He was a member of Parliament, the NDP, for a long time. He used to tell me, we were in the Young New Democrats together back in the 70s. He used to joke about it. You know, he got his operating instructions from the head of the caucus about what, how they were to vote. And they couldn't vote any other way or they'd be bounced immediately out. And who does that person get their orders from? I mean, you know, it's like, follow that and you'll know who really runs things. And if you do buck the system, you're never heard of again. That's the point. If you are like that honest person in the system, it spits you out like Neo in the Matrix. You know, you're just down the toilet right away. And you're made to think that that's a problem, but it isn't. It's the first step towards your freeing so that you can start to build something different. We got to pull. It's kind of like a collapsing balloon. The system operates parasitically on all of us, taxes, energetically, our thoughts. If we start withdrawing that, even a few of us, it starts going, they lose their power, and we start building up our own. And that kind of graphically has to be how we envision it. We're building up a new dynamic over here and ignoring their system, right?
Yeah, I agree. It seems like it's maybe a race against time, because we've got with this WHO pandemic treaty getting signed, and with the threat of these military conflicts all over the world right now, I just don't know if we're going to have time to do that.
Just one thing on that. We don't have to worry about time, because time's actually on our side. Things have to get a lot worse before people are willing to act. And frankly, I hope we go through a lot more suffering, because that's really the only thing that's going to get people's back to the wall. When people's backs are to the wall, that's when they start to fight. And that's why Sun Tzu in The Art of War says, never push an enemy into a corner, because then they're going to come out fighting. And that's where more of us are ending up. And so we should welcome that and say, how are we going to unite now and create our own alternative? That's our real pushback, right?
Okay. So, we've got some websites we can go to, but is there any final thoughts you want to leave people with here today, or any final call to action, at least for today? Because we can have you back, Kevin, and when you come to Ontario,
I'd love we'll to be
glad
live.
To have you in studio as
on
well.
On the Starship Enterprise there, because I often say, Scotty, beam me out of this situation.
Well, maybe
let's do it.
Okay. What is there something you want to leave people with that they can do, though?
Yeah, there's actually some events coming up in Toronto. Saturday, May 4th, there's going to be kind of a meeting of people who are working along the lines of the Republic and all these issues we've talked about. The next day, Sunday, May 5th, there's going to be actual actions at the downtown churches. There's a whole banishment and reclamation campaign Indigenous elders have launched, saying the land and properties of these churches are forfeited now as reparations for the genocide of our children. And we have the right to peacefully take them. And so there's going to be actions around that. And it's interesting, the next day, Monday, May 6th, is Holocaust Remembrance Day. Well, we say now it's time for domestic Holocaust remembrance. And what happened here? So early May, there's going to be those events in Toronto. You can write to us, angelfire101@protonmail.com is the way to get more information on any of that. Murderbydecree.com, you can see our websites, also the Republic site. And also to flag the fact that this is really a very exciting time, because all over the country, I'm on the road a lot, and I see an amazing, not just awakening happening, but people are right at that point where things are going to tip and there's going to be all sorts of new things happening. And I just want to urge people to not give up, especially now. And we're doing a blog show every Sunday as well. 6 p.m. Eastern. It's called Here We Stand. bbsradio.com/Here We Stand. And all the shows going back 10 years are listed there, all our work. It's a good listen. So I would say, you know, if you want to get involved in this stuff, look forward to meeting all of you in Toronto and beyond. And let's make it happen, people.
Okay, and there's three websites anywhere people can go, including the BBS Radio one. And the email address was angelfire101@protonmail.com, right,
That's it. Kevin?
Okay. Well, this has been fun. Yeah, good sure to see you again. And I look forward to seeing you in person later in the month or in May. And I look forward to those activities in Toronto in May as well. So
thanks. Thanks so much, Hugh.
Yeah.
See you later.
It's been great. Thanks. Cheers. We'll be right back after this.